I remember being in Phoenix, Arizona, to sit down with a group called Jody Arias is Innocent. The name and the mission are self-explanatory. They believe that Jody Arias, one of the most infamous murderers in America, should be released from prison.
Police announced the arrest of Jody Arias today.
And I'm here with Jody Arias. Is that how you say your last name? Arias, okay.
Jody Arias was convicted of murdering her ex-boyfriend, Travis Alexander, in his home. His body was discovered on June 9th, 2008, in the shower of the master bedroom, 4 days after he was killed.
You know, I'm not an evil person.
I know you're not.
And I'm not a promiscuous person.
What followed was chaos.
An obsessed lover filled with jealousy and rage.
Non-stop speculation.
According to friends, Arias stalked Alexander for months.
And a trial that unfolded in real time before a national audience.
This case became a public spectacle.
Everyone was talking about it. News stories, 24-hour news things were picking it up and, you know, all around the clock.
And at the center of it, a 28-year-old woman, her story shifting, fracturing, reshaping itself every time it was told.
And then when her friends called her and told her that he died, she totally freaked out, like she knew nothing about it. I mean, how can somebody do that?
Now, nearly every convicted killer that I've ever spoken with claims they're railroaded. But this group, Jody Arias is Innocent, isn't arguing that she didn't kill Travis Alexander. They're arguing something more complicated.
Arias' legal team has filed a new appeal, alleging prosecutorial misconduct. Arias now claims newly surfaced evidence supports her defense and is asking to be released.
I've reviewed her entire appeal, more than 300 pages. I've spoken with her supporters, I've gone back through the evidence, and now I'm questioning whether or not Jody Arias should still be in prison.
The defendant shall be incarcerated in the Department of Corrections for the rest of her natural life with no possibility of parole.
So I'm gonna lay out what I found. We'll walk through the case, examine the evidence that Jody has provided me, and in the end, you can decide for yourself. I'm James Buddy Day. This is Unmarked. For more than a decade, I've tried to convince Jody Arias to speak with me on the record. She hasn't. Since her trial and incarceration, Jody no longer trusts anyone to tell her story. She believes that the truth can only exist in one place, the court. I told her what I was planning to do, that I'd go back through the evidence, read the appeals, speak to her supporters, that I would tell the story with or without her participation. And if I got something wrong, I'd own it. The last time I asked her to speak on the record, she wrote me back. In an email, she said, quote, "You can do all of that without me. If you believe as you say, then my inability to participate won't stop you. Thanks for your persistence, buddy." I really hope she means it. I hope this episode sparks conversation, and I hope when I go back to her again, that she'll decide to speak. Until then, here's what you need to know. Travis Alexander's body was found in his Mesa, Arizona home on June 9th, 2008. Police found blood spatter across the bathroom and down the hallway. Police also found the killer's fingerprints. In the washing machine, they found Travis's camera still intact, containing time-stamped photographs taken minutes before his death. The images were graphic. The fingerprints and the photographs belonged to Alexander's ex-girlfriend, Jody Arias. She initially denied any knowledge of the crime, despite forensic evidence placing her at the scene. During her interrogation, she laughed, sang, and did headstands. When confronted with the evidence, her story changed. First, she claimed a home invasion.
He just held the gun to my head and he was like, "You don't go anywhere." And he told the other girl to finish it.
It's just so far-fetched. I can't believe it. Why would they do this to him? What were they arguing about? What did they say?
They didn't say a lot. They were white Americans from what I could tell.
Later, she said she acted in self-defense.
You killed Travis Alexander on June 4th, 2008.
Yes, I did.
Why?
The simple answer is that he attacked me, and I defended myself.
And the image of a young, attractive killer ex-girlfriend willing to speak publicly is what drew national media attention. While in custody, Jodi Arias appeared on Inside Edition. Coverage exploded. Celebrity commentary followed. Even Donald Trump weighed in, tweeting she was, quote, as guilty as it gets. CNN built a channel around the case called Headline News. Viewership climbed into the millions. Before jurors had even heard the case, Nancy Grace declared Jodi Arias unequivocally guilty.
Arias spews lie after lie, trying to convince the media she's innocent.
The striking thing about the case is that it depends entirely on perspective. Seen one way, Jodi Arias looks calculating, manipulative, capable of extraordinary violence. But seen another way, she looks unstable, emotionally trapped, and deeply human. The facts don't change, but the interpretation does. So from here on, we're going to examine this case through both lenses. The best place to begin is 2006, when Jodi Arias and Travis Alexander meet at a conference in Las Vegas for a company called Prepaid Legal Services. But to understand what that meeting meant to her, you have to back up. From Jodi's point of view, she's 26 years old and still trying to assemble a stable sense of who she is. She doesn't arrive in Las Vegas grounded or settled.
Yeah, I guess me coming from Salinas. I used to go to sleep at night and I would hear gunshots. We weren't in a bad neighborhood.
Throughout this episode, you'll hear from Jodi in her own words, from multiple interrogations she willingly took part in after her arrest.
Our neighborhood, another neighborhood, it wasn't that great, and gunshots, scary. And there, because Salinas is agricultural and there are a lot of fields, and I used to think that there were hunters in the fields.
To separate fact from fiction, I've arranged to speak with Alice LaViolette. She's one of America's leading experts on domestic and intimate partner violence. In 2013, she was retained by the defense team to evaluate Jodi Arias in prison. If you want the full conversation with Alice LaViolette, including her personal account of what it was like to testify in one of the most watched trials in America, it's available inside our Patreon called Unmarked Case Files, the archive behind this podcast.
I went and I spent 8 hours the first day, no food, no water. We sat and talked for 8 hours. The next day I went in for 6 and I found her to be credible.
Prior to 2006, there are allegations of abuse in the Arias household, but the picture is unclear. Conflict is documented, however, yelling and volatility confirmed by her siblings.
When she got involved in Prepaid Legal, she came from a certain amount of trauma. I would say her father was emotionally abusive to mom and even to Jodi. He was a guy taking a lot of steroids. And she was also one of 4 children, and she was different than the other 3 kids. She was very artistic. She was more kind of woo-woo, if you will. She was just a different person. She was odd man out odd girl out in the family.
As a teenager, Jodi's relationship with her parents is strained. She's arrested at one point for growing marijuana. She's reportedly highly secretive, easily provoked, and increasingly isolated.
If you deal with untreated trauma, you got a problem when you've got that degree of trauma.
Jodi drops out of high school and leaves home to live with her boyfriend. She works odd jobs and drifts. At 23, she begins dating Daryl Brewer, her former manager at a luxury resort where they both work. Brewer is 42 years old at the time. The relationship escalates quickly. They buy a house together in Palm Desert. And as Jody recalls, her parents never visit.
I had a house with a free bedroom and a bed and a pool and everything you could want, and they never came to visit me once. It's my first home. I'm sorry, this is all stupid and it's irrelevant.
The relationship doesn't last. By 2006, Arias and Brewer break up. She's working three jobs, but loses the house, and tells her parents she's planning to file for bankruptcy. At this point, the pattern is becoming clear. Years later, Jody Arias will be diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, a condition defined not by violence, but instability. Unstable identity, unstable relationships, intense emotions, and an overwhelming fear of abandonment. What matters here is not the label, it's what the diagnosis helps explain. Someone with bipolar personality disorder doesn't experience the world in gradients. They experience everything in extremes. Connections feel like survival, and rejection feels existential. And that's why Jody is drawn to the Prepaid Legal Services Convention in 2006. PPL is a legal subscription service. How it works is you pay a monthly fee for access to legal help. But the business relies heavily on multi-level marketing. These companies thrive on ambition and aggressive sales culture, motivational audio, personal reinvention, a constant hustle. It's not Wolf of Wall Street, but it's close.
Prepaid Legal, the focus was on the power positive thinking kind of, intention.
When Jody finds PPL, it offers exactly what she's been missing. Certainty, identity, validation, and a community that rewards intensity. But the PPL convention means the opposite to Travis Alexander.
When she met Travis at Prepaid Legal, she was with friends, and he was one of the speakers. He was already kind of up the pyramid, if you would.
His upbringing has made him the kind of hustler that thrives in these types of organizations. Charismatic, outgoing, charming, and not afraid to push limits. Now, Travis had a very troubled childhood. His parents struggle with crystal meth addiction. This according to Chad Perkins, one of Travis's closest friends, who told us about those early days.
He was raised in a really rough part of town, and just going to his house kind of freaked me out because it was like a really scary, sketchy place. His mom had some substance issues and would leave when he was younger before he went to his grandma's. She would leave for like a week or two at a time. And I remember Travis saying that he had to like eat dog food and whatever was around. He had to scrounge, and there was just, everything was just covered in cockroaches.
Arrest records show that many of Travis's seven siblings did not escape their home life unscathed. Convictions for controlled substances, theft, methamphetamine manufacturing, it continues to plague the family for years. Travis Alexander's father dies in 1997, during Travis's teenage years, during an adolescence marked by violence and instability.
I think, like, talking to him about his pre-church life, he would tell me that like he would fight all the time. He used to fight all the time. Like before he came to church, he would just get in fights for the sake of getting in fights. Like someone would agitate him and he would just want to go and fight.
Eventually, Travis is taken in by his grandmother. But even then, he continues to struggle with anger and impulse control until he finds something that offers structure and meaning. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Travis and I were in a church pre-missionary program. Like, they have a little program to like help missionaries get ready to be missionaries. And so we met in that class. I remember he was trying really hard to be more like churchy. He really wanted to be better. His grandma was religious, and he really, really loved his grandma because his grandma basically raised him. So he wanted to, you know, be better for her.
For Travis, The Mormon Church and PPL offer the version of himself he's trying hard to live up to. But even then, he's divided between who he had been and who he is trying to become.
He had a really difficult time having a real, genuine relationship. Once someone was interested in him, he just kind of like lost interest. It was very like a game-ish thing for him. It was very cat and mouse. He really loved flirting. But once it came to actually opening his heart to somebody and settling in, he really, really struggled with that.
To Travis, Jody embodies an escape from rules, from expectations, from consequence. But for Jody, Travis represents structure, status, certainty, and someone worth anchoring to.
Most women just fall all over themselves for Travis because he's nice and he seems like the whole package.
They fulfill something in each other that neither one has on their own.
We mixed really well for a time, and I really did see, like, inside, he was an amazing person. He was a good person. He was a generous person. He gave so much. She spends a lot of time with
him. In that first week, everything moves quickly. The relationship becomes intimate almost immediately, even as Travis tries to reconcile his faith and public life.
They do okay as long as the energy for new love covers up the fear. But when the fear starts showing, then you wind up seeing what happens.
For Jody, she's attaching. For her, intimacy is not casual. It's anchoring. It's identity forming. Where Travis is compartmentalizing. He's trying to keep parts of himself separate. And that tension has to be resolved. And they arrive at a solution that serves them both. On November 26, 2006, Jody Arias is baptized into the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
And he mentioned that he had met Jody and that he was teaching her the gospel or baptized her or something like that. I'm not sure where that was in the point. I don't recall exactly, but I know that she was coming to church and she was like working with him a little bit, and he was really smitten by how beautiful she was.
For Jody, the baptism isn't a gesture. It's a vow. A way of proving she belongs in Travis's world. She later testifies that after her baptism, the intimacy becomes more extreme. For Travis, it's desire colliding with discipline, a line he keeps crossing, then pretends isn't there.
Travis was very honest, more than most, about being curious. But when it comes to sharing what you're going through as far as like sexual experiences or any kind of sin at all in the church, it's very taboo to share and talk about that.
I've looked through all the text messages presented at trial, and they're intense. Sometimes romantic, sometimes explicit, sometimes degrading, and sometimes very aggressive in tone. On paper, the exchanges appear consensual, but consent, control, and power can look very different depending on where you're standing. And Jody and Travis break up within about 6 months. Over the next 2 years, Jody continually travels back and forth between California and Arizona.
He was so generous when I moved there. He let me store all my stuff there because I went from a house to a room. And so I had artwork, I paint, art supplies, photos. Books.
It's in this time period that the relationship evolves into something else, a carefully guarded secret.
You guys had a different kind of relationship. You guys were happy to see each other, but for some reason he couldn't outwardly show it in public.
He was
afraid of his image, and to him his image was everything.
This is a guy who cared very much about his image, a guy who had a secret relationship. Obviously, they were both, you know, Jody describes it as addictive, and I would say it is. Very addictive relationship, real highs, real lows. I mean, it's like an adrenaline junkie, you know?
From Travis's point of view, this is not his future. He wants to marry a good Mormon woman. For Jody, being Travis's secret is temporary, a speed bump she believes they'll eventually move past. She excuses his behavior. She reframes it.
He told me on several occasions it saddened him and it bothered him. He had two friends in particular that gave him a very hard time about our friendship. But I think they did it out of concern for his future, his marital status.
When speaking with Arias' supporters, this is the period that they point to as evidence of abuse. They argue that Travis Alexander used isolation, shaming, and control to manipulate Jody, maintaining intimacy while withholding commitment. And they're not just talking in abstractions. They point to a discernible pattern in their electronic communication. Messages that are harsh, demeaning at times, and intentionally withholding. I won't read them here, but the tone is unmistakable.
I started reading the things he'd write to her. He called her names, he put her down, and she didn't have anybody to talk to. One of the things I would say is they both lived in isolation, and isolation is a really, it's pernicious. Travis had this side of his life completely secret, so he was isolated in effect, and that doesn't bode well for anybody.
Not that this justifies any subsequent violence, but it does show a relational dynamic built on control and emotional asymmetry. Eventually, Travis begins to date another woman, most notably a fellow Mormon named Lisa Andrews. This is Jody's father, Bill Arias, telling investigators what he remembers.
She called me crying hysterically when she decided to move to Mesa, Arizona. She snuck up at his house and she looked in the window and she saw him there on the couch with another woman. And she was planning on marrying this guy. So she just left.
What happens next remains unexplained, and I've scoured the court records, police reports, and trial testimony to try and put it together. Lisa Andrews reports that her car tires are slashed multiple times in 2007. Now, from Travis's point of view, he believes Jody is responsible for this, and he notes other suspicions about her escalating behavior to his friends and family. This again is Travis's close friend, Chad Perkins.
In January of that year, we had a phone conversation and I asked him, what about the girl you were dating? And he was like, oh, it's crazy. It's like this fatal attraction stuff. And I'll tell you all about it when I see you in person, but it was crazy.
Now, the sentiment wasn't limited to Chad Perkins. Investigators later confirmed that Travis Alexander described Jody as a, quote, stalker to multiple people in his life. That matters. But it's also difficult to know how much weight to give that characterization. Even as he pulls back publicly, Travis remains in regular contact with Jody through phone calls, emails, and texts. He sustains emotional and at times sexual intimacy in private.
In June, they were still having a sexual relationship. So and that seems very Travis. He was very human to me that he really didn't want to be with her. He knew it was unsafe, but it was very pleasurable and very gratifying.
From Jody's perspective, the contact never really stopped. The calls, emails, and texts signal that the relationship still matters.
The only person that said she was a stalker was Travis telling people that. Because I think he was really hiding the relationship. But I had emails saying, hey, come on over to the house. I'm not home yet. There's guac in the fridge. You have a key. None of the stuff that supports the stalker allegations.
The tipping point is a trip to Cancun. Travis Alexander is scheduled to leave on June 10th, 2008, a reward he earns for a strong sales performance with PPL. On paper, it's a business incentive, but in reality, it throws a harsh light on the tension that's already building between him and Jody, because it becomes clear that Travis plans to take another woman on the trip. From Jody's point of view, it's hard to imagine this landing softly. For someone with borderline personality disorder, that kind of rupture can feel catastrophic. But Jody Arias denies being upset about Cancun. Listen to how she explains it.
Like, we found out about Cancun a year prior, right about the time we broke up. And so, like, I never really assumed that I had a ticket there.
Months leading up to the trip, Jody and Travis were speaking on the phone for hours at a time. It strains belief that Cancun, scheduled just days after his death, never came up.
And, you know, as things went on, it was just never discussed, so there was never any discussion.
Then shortly before the trip, something changes. Jody attends another PPL conference and meets someone new. If Cancun represented rejection or a placement, PPL once again offers what it had before: certainty, identity, and a community that rewards Jody's intensity. This is Ryan Burns, the man Jody met at that conference, recalling their first encounter.
I went to the conference for the company we were working with. I went there with a few of my buddies. Most of us were single guys, so of course we were at Convention to Learn Business, but we're also scoping out, you know, what's going on, because this is probably a better place to meet somebody, you know, than at the bar or something. We saw her and a friend that she was walking with, and instantly, you know, my buddy Michael was like, dude, let's go talk to those girls.
Like many of Jody's relationships, it escalates very quickly.
At 11 o'clock, almost like I could put my phone down on the coffee table and I could tell somebody, like, watch, 11:01. Ring every night. 4 or 5 times a week she'd call, and we'd talk for a long time. Travis came up a few times in our conversations, and I had never really known their history, so any conversations about Travis was just positive things. He was a great guy, just didn't work out, you know, we had different goals in mind, and so we just learned that it just wasn't a good fit. That was the entire relationship that I knew of with Travis and Jody.
At this point, we're 3 days before the murder. Jody Arias tells both her parents and Ryan Burns that she's planning a road trip from California to Utah before attending another sales convention in Los Angeles.
I was in Salt Lake City. She was in Northern California somewhere. And she said, guess what? I said, what? She said, I'm going to be going on a little road trip, and I want to stop by Utah and come and see you. And I was like, awesome. That'd be great.
Jody did end up in Utah, but before that, she ends up somewhere else entirely. She goes to Mesa, Arizona, to Travis Alexander's house where the murder takes place. Now, the question is why? On Monday, June 2nd, 2008, Jody set out. But why did she change her destination from Utah to Arizona?
She changed her plans, and she changed her plans because Travis kind of said, please come out. He contacted Jody and he said, don't you love me anymore? Aren't you? And he sort of guilt tripped her. And that's when she changed her plans to actually stop there before she went to Utah.
At trial, the prosecution scrutinizes this trip in extraordinary detail. They argue that her actions reflect intent, that she's concealing her movements in order to murder Travis Alexander. But another reading is much more mundane. Jody Arias made planned stops, visited friends, and used a debit card to pay for gas. She created a trail that was easy to follow. And even if she does intend to arrive at Travis's house discreetly, that alone would not have been unusual. The relationship had been kept private for years. This again is Ryan Burns, who was a first person witness to Jody's plans.
It was about that time, around 9 or 10 o'clock, she was going to be leaving Southern California to come straight to Utah, which I was trying to talk her out of that, because it was like, that means she's going to be driving at 2 a.m., 3 a.m., 4 a.m., 5 and 6 a.m., like in the middle of the night. And she's like, no, I'm good.
What we know is that at approximately 4 a.m., Jody arrives at Travis Alexander's home in Mesa. At the time, Travis has two roommates, Enrique Cortez and Zach Billings. Both are asleep.
Zach was there.
Zach and Enrique was the other one.
There's no evidence of forced entry, and roommates later testify that Travis sometimes let people in through the garage using the keypad rather than keys. This is Enrique Cortez, who was in the house on that night.
Some people knew Travis's garage code like I did. Like if he was gonna be gone and needed somebody to feed Napoleon, they could just let themselves in and out through the garage.
Timestamps on the digital camera found at the scene tell us that Arias and Alexander took a series of nude photographs of each other in the early morning hours. The last known image of Travis alive is timestamped at approximately 5:29 a.m. There are several photos just before that, around 5:24 a.m., and they show Travis inside the shower.
Is that the one with him in the shower? Yeah, he had water all over his face. You took a nice picture of him. He would never let me take pictures of him in a shower.
Sometime after the final photograph, Travis Alexander is killed. And this is where perspective collapses.
She said that he wanted her to take pictures of him from the waist up, from the shower, because he'd been working out. And she dropped the camera, and that he got really pissed off about that.
According to her account, Travis became enraged. They struggle. She went to his bedroom and retrieved a gun.
The gun went off. I didn't mean to shoot him or anything. I didn't even think I was holding the trigger. I just was pointing it at him. And I didn't even know that I shot him. It just went off, and he lunged at me, and we fell really hard against the tile toward the other wall.
There is no competing narrative, because Travis is no longer alive. From this point forward, the only account of what happens comes from Jody and from the physical evidence left behind. So to understand what unfolded in those final minutes, we have to set testimony aside and look instead at the blood evidence. That's where the sequence becomes clear. Inside the bathroom, investigators documented a U-shaped blood pooling pattern that begins near the shower and culminates at the sink. The sink itself is covered in active blood flow, along with Travis Alexander's palm prints clearly visible. It indicates that Travis was alive, upright, and bleeding heavily when he reached the sink. He had enough strength to brace himself and look into the mirror with his back to Jody. It's evidence of a pause in the violence. Now, this pause could indicate confusion, shock, or a moment when the danger felt temporarily contained. And whatever the explanation, the blood evidence tells us that Travis moves from the sink into the hallway where the confrontation escalates. The autopsy later confirms that Arias stabbed Alexander 3 times fatally, while his body bears more than 24 superficial wounds. What the evidence shows is not a clean, singular act, but a frantic, chaotic struggle, one that unfolds across multiple spaces, one that neither person appears to have fully anticipated.
Frankly, you know, James, I think when somebody starts stabbing somebody, I don't think they stop, because stabbing is very personal, and I think you lose your cortex. I think you go right into your primitive brain, and it's all about survival.
And this is further illustrated by Jody's behavior after the murder. Jody's actions are not especially careful or sophisticated. They're clumsy and disorganized. She places Travis's camera inside the washing machine, where it's later found by police. She leaves fingerprints. She leaves behind ample evidence that ultimately lead investigators straight to her. And that matters, because it complicates the idea of a meticulously planned crime.
If it was premeditated, she could have shot him at the door. They were having sex, he was asleep. She could have killed him then. I don't think it was premeditated. Battered women's defense is not a get out of jail free card. But I never thought it should have been first degree. I thought it should have been second degree murder or voluntary manslaughter.
But all this is why I've come to question whether Jody Arias should still be in prison. Because the trial is where all of these perspectives and interpretations are supposed to be weighed. And they weren't. From the beginning, during one of the most salacious trials in American history, Arias's legal team argued that the prosecution delayed the handover of evidence, prejudiced the jury, and made improper arguments that went way beyond the evidence.
I didn't know what a media circus was, and this was absolutely a media circus. And I was stunned by it, and I was stunned that I started getting death threats the second week.
And for years, these allegations were dismissed.
They would throw anything and see if it stuck. They said I would be arrested for perjury, and I didn't perjure myself.
But something happened in 2019. Something changed. The State Bar of Arizona filed a formal disciplinary complaint against Juan Martinez, the lead prosecutor in the Arias case.
The State Bar of Arizona announced today that Juan Martinez consented to disbarment, effective immediately.
Juan Martinez had me called into chambers with the judge and said I was leaking information on the case, which I didn't. He was, though. At the time, he was leaking information on the case.
Bar investigators concluded that there was probable cause that Martinez violated professional rules governing attorneys. The complaint alleged that Martinez leaked confidential, non-public information during the Arias trial, that he lied to bar investigators about those leaks, and he repeatedly sexually harassed women working in the Maricopa County Attorney's Office. And get this, not only has the Jody Arias prosecutor been disbarred, her own defense attorney was also disbarred. After the case, Kirk Nurmi, the attorney who defended Arias, agreed to be disbarred for writing a tell-all book and violating numerous legal ethics and client confidentiality. This doesn't answer all the questions of guilt, but it explains why we're still talking about the Jody Arias case and why Jody Arias is innocent even exists in the first place. There's no closure here. It's all a matter of competing perspectives.
I mean, what she did, that's terrible. That Travis was killed is terrible. Did the criminal justice system give her a fair trial? I don't think so.
So is Jody Arias really innocent? We don't know. And that's the problem. Not because the evidence is thin, not because the facts aren't disturbing, but because this case doesn't turn on a single truth. The whole thing turns on interpretation. And because the courtroom, where those interpretations are supposed to be tested slowly, carefully, fairly, where evidence is weighed without spectacle, where process protects truth even when that truth is uncomfortable, the question at the center of this case will remain open. Not did something terrible happen, but did we get this right? And that may be the most unsettling verdict of all. There's more to this conversation than what made it into this episode. The full extended interview with Alice LaViolette, including the portions where we go deeper into the relationship between Arias and Alexander, is now available inside our Patreon, Unmarked Case Files. That's where the longer calls, primary documents, and ad-free episodes live. If you want to continue this discussion, it's linked across our socials. This episode of Unmarked was produced by John Nadeau and edited by Dave Alderson. Our additional producer is Jesse Demaray. We've got much more coming soon, and if you're still here, you're already part of what is making this work.